Hello everyone, and thank you for joining today's webinar, Using Microsoft R Server to Address Scalability Issues. Presenting today is Derek Norton, Senior Data Scientist here at Microsoft. Before we begin, I'd like to cover a few housekeeping items. Today's presentation will run about an hour. The webinar is being recorded and will be available on demand within 48 hours. A copy of today's presentation along with the recording link will be sent to you via email once the files are available. If you have any questions during the webcast, please enter your question in the Q&A widget on the left of your screen and click Submit. We'll try and get through as many questions as we can during the live broadcast. But before we start our presentation, I'd like to run a quick couple of polls. Our first poll, which statement best describes our experience? These polls help Derek tailor the presentation. So your help in answering these polls are greatly appreciated. I'll go ahead and share the poll results now. So 47% intermediate R user, 23% just learning R, experienced R user at 27%. So lots of R users. Our next poll. Which statement best describes your role? You have analyst, statistician, software developer, DBA, manager, or other. Have a couple more seconds. And go ahead and close the poll. Looks like 71% analyst, statistician, or data scientist. Great. Thank you so much for participating. I'd like to go ahead and turn over the presentation over to our speaker. Derek, please go ahead.
All right, thank you very much, Yanni. As Yanni said, this is Derek Norton. I'm a senior data scientist at Microsoft, and I was at Revolution Analytics prior to this, so this is something I've been working with for quite some time. Also the founder and director of the Atlanta R User Group, so R is something that's actually really important to me and something I'm quite passionate about. Well, let's go ahead and jump in and talk a little bit about how Microsoft R Server can assist with dealing with some scalability things. First off, to start off, let's talk about what is R. And I think we saw most everyone knew what R is. There were a small percentage, maybe just a few people that said, what is R? And we'll cover that just a little bit. So what is R? First off, it's a open source modeling, analytics, computation framework. It's a programming language. It's often cited as the lingua franca for analytics. It's also a global community. There are millions of users out there who are quite passionate about the R language and the R community and contribute back to it. That contribution is part of what's the ecosystem. There are 7,000 plus algorithms, tests, data, evaluations, packages available on CRAN or the Comprehensive R Archive Network, as well as some other repositories that are out there. So the community contributes quite a lot back. Now, R itself, there are ways you can scale it to big data and big analytics. However, sometimes those are a little bit difficult. And today we'll show how some of those are made easy with Microsoft R Server. So what does R for Microsoft bring you? Just a little bit of high level, to bring you some peace of mind, understanding that you have someone backing an open source product, efficiency, and this is the majority of what we'll focus on today, the efficiency in computation and deployment of the computation that you're doing, speed and scalability. So efficiency and speed and scalability are the two pieces that we're going to focus almost exclusively on today, and we'll talk mostly about how we are scaling, and then some of the demonstration later will show how some things that may not work in open source R will easily work in Microsoft R Server, but also flexibility and agility. And so I have a bit of a section at the end that we'll talk a bit more about how some of what you can do can be pushed out to various parallel backends and things like that. So if you think about it, there are pretty much three products that are offered from Microsoft. Microsoft R Open, which is a free and open source R distribution. There was a webinar just recently that David Smith did to talk specifically about Microsoft R Open. It's an enhanced distribution of R. This is distributed by Revolution Analytics, but now by Microsoft. There's also the SQL R services, which is built in advanced analytics, standalone server capability. It leverages the benefits of SQL 2016 and works inside of the database. There'll be a webinar upcoming about that. Jamie Olson will be presenting, so I'm not going to talk much about that other than that it is there, and there'll be more specifics in his webinar. Today, I'm going to talk about Microsoft R Server. However, I will say that much of what I talk about is actually valid for SQL Server also. Microsoft R Server is a product that runs on Red Hat Linux, SUSE Linux, in database and Teradata, as well as in Hadoop. So first off, let me talk just a bit about Microsoft R Open. Again, if you are signed up for the previous webinar, you should be able to watch that and get a lot more depth. I'm going to talk just a bit about it. But Microsoft R Open is an enhanced open source R distribution. The one I'm going to be showing today, at least, is based on the latest open source of 3.2.2, built and tested and distributed by Microsoft. It's enhanced by the Intel Math Kernel Libraries, which means that your linear algebra functions, your matrix algebra, things you're doing there, will actually make use of the Intel Math Kernel Libraries, which means that they are now multi-threaded. It's compatible with all R-related software, so all your CRAN packages, if you're used to using RStudio, it works with that. The third-party R integrations, it works the same. It also includes some things specifically that we built for it, some open-source R packages, the reproducible R toolkit, which includes Checkpoint and Minicran, Parallel R to parallelize execution via for loops, the R Hadoop project, which includes some packages like RHDFS, RHBase, RAvro, RMR2, and PlyRMR, as well as Azure ML, which allows you to read and write data to Azure Machine Learning, as well as publish R code directly as a machine learning API, really enabling you to push the work that you may do locally out into the cloud quite easily there. Also, we maintain MRAN, which is like CRAN or CRAN, the Comprehensive R Archive Network, and we maintain that. And MRAN is a managed version. It has enhanced documentation and learning resources. It includes snapshots that are actually used with the Checkpoint packages. Microsoft R Open is open source. It's GPL version 2, 100% free to download, use, and share. Now, just a bit of a benchmark, and again, if you want to see more about this, I think you can go and look at David's webinar, but there are some performance improvements, as I said, because the Intel Math Kernel Libraries allow multi-threading for the work that you're doing that leverages linear algebra and matrix algebra. Now, also, oftentimes, the algorithms themselves, even if single-threaded, are a little more efficient depending on what version of BLASH you're using currently. So as you can see here, you can often see speedups as much as 27 times faster, all the way down to no faster, because if I'm doing things like for loops and things like that, well, guess what? There's no linear algebra, so there is no real speedup. But anything that actually leverages any linear algebra, you should see some speedup. All right, so now Microsoft R Server, and you'll see why I was talking about Microsoft R Open once we get into this. What is Microsoft R Server? We'll start with a little bit of motivation first off. Why do we need something beyond just CRAN R or even Microsoft R Open, the open source distribution that we provide? If we look at data sizes, Microsoft R Open, you'll see, is very similar to open source R in many of these boxes, except for the speed, since we have the multi-threaded processing. But when we're doing processing, we're doing in-memory processing. So this means that, 99% or so of all open source R packages really require you to bring all of your data into RAM. There are some that don't, but it's a very small percentage. Support for those and usability is sometimes difficult. So seeing as you have to bring all that into RAM, that means that you actually have to have a machine large enough to actually hold all of your data. And sometimes that's not quite that easy. Microsoft R Server was developed to allow for doing in-memory processing as you need to, but also disk-based processing, so that you can write to disk as your data grows and is larger than RAM. You can actually do processing on things much larger than your available RAM. And we'll demonstrate some of that in code a little bit later. This Speedtomb analytics piece, you know, we step from open source R with single-threaded execution, multi-threaded execution through the Intel math kernel libraries is brought with Microsoft R Open. And then Microsoft Server actually allows multi-threaded execution as well as parallel processing for some of the computations. And we'll see, again, in code how some of that's done a little bit later. Support's another piece that motivated the creation of what is now Microsoft R Server. Open source R, of course, was community supported. Microsoft R Open is community supported, though backed by Microsoft. Microsoft R Server has a community backing in the exact same way open source R would, but it also has a commercial license which allows for a commercial support. Now, the positive here is that Microsoft R Server is built upon Microsoft R Open. And since Microsoft R Open is 100% compatible with open source R, that means that Microsoft R Server is also 100% compatible with open source R. It's simply an enhancement to that. Again, as we talked a bit about support, the same is true for license. Open source licenses for open source R and Microsoft R Open, but of course, a commercial license that provides supported release with Indemnity. All right, so what is Microsoft R Server? A little bit of a high level, and then we'll go into a little bit of depth. Microsoft R Server, as it says, is a broadly deployable enterprise-class analytic platform. It's based on R, supported, scalable, and secure. And you can see a bit of a box down there at the right-hand corner that shows some components of Microsoft R Server. These components provide high-performance open source R plus these components that are, you know, data source connectivity to big data objects, big data advanced analytics, multi-platform environment support in Hadoop, in Teradata predictive modeling, as well as, you know, the upcoming in SQL Server, as well as development and production environment support. So now let's go into a little bit more depth about some of these things. So Microsoft R Server, you can see, is split into two broad groups, and that's the open piece, the open source piece, and then the Microsoft R Server piece itself. Microsoft R Server is built upon the open source piece and requires it since we're running R, and we want to ensure that when we do things, it is R-like, of course. So we start off with R, which is the open source R interpreter, and I'll apologize. This should say 3.2.2 for the version I'm going to show today. It's built upon R plus Gram. So everything that you would normally be used to using with open source R is there. 100% compatible with the scripts that you have. But we add the extra functionality brought by Microsoft R Open, and that is that performance enhanced R interpreter with the Intel Math Kernel Library. Now, once we have that, pretty much Microsoft R Open in the left-hand box there, we move to what is Microsoft R Server in the right-hand large box. And there's a few pieces here. Pardon me. If we start at the very bottom, we have distributed R. And we can think of distributed R as the distributed computing framework that the rest of Microsoft R Server actually operates on. It delivers cross-platform portability to a variety of platforms. The next piece is ScaleR, and ScaleR is a lot of what we're going to see when we look at code a little bit later, and actually a lot about how we think about how Microsoft R Server does the work it's doing. But ScaleR is a collection of ready-to-use, high-performance, big data analytics functions. They're fully parallelized. They include things like data prep and distillation, descriptive statistics, a range of predictive functions, as well as tools for distributing customized R algorithms across nodes. And a wide variety of data sets are supported there. Excuse me, not a wide variety, but a wide data sets are supported. When we talk about variety of data sets, that's the ConnectR piece. ConnectR is a collection of high-speed and direct connectors for various data sources. The first piece there you see is what's called the high-performance XDF, and we'll see that again a little bit later when we look at the code. The XDF stands for external data frame, and it is the most efficient format that we can use when we're actually going to do processing with Microsoft R Server. We also have connectivity into SAS, SPSS files, delimited and fixed width text files, as well as data that would sit on HDFS. So we can operate on data in HDFS, and we'll talk a bit later that some of that work can be done by pulling locally, or it can be done by pushing that work to that distributed compute context. The same is also true for Teradata. and ODBC connectivity. All right, so we think of ScaleR, as we saw on the last slide there. What is ScaleR and what's happening there? We start off with, as we look at the left-hand side here, we have our big data. Think about a data that may well be larger than the available RAM that we have. That data is then broken into chunks. If it's in an XDF file, that file is actually optimized to work with ScaleR and significantly speeds up iterative algorithm processing. That file is actually pre-blocked. So when we create that file, the data is broken into blocks that are predefined. If we're reading from another data source, like a text file or something like that, we'll just read a certain number of rows at a time, and those will count as a block. Now, one of those blocks at a time is then fed through on a single machine, the core, one core will actually feed the other cores, and the work can be done in parallel there. The same is actually true also as we move into distributed compute context, where we have multiple nodes. We just have a single node that then feeds the other nodes, like the single core feeds the other cores on a single node. Now, once each one of these processing steps are done, the interim results are collected and combined to produce the output that we would expect to see. What this means is that we can really operate on any size data. It doesn't matter if it fits into RAM, because we're never going to bring all the data into RAM at one time. So here's a bit of a list about what sort of algorithms have been already been addressed and written to be scalable. You see your data preparation type functions like importation. We mentioned those, the importing delimited files fixed with SAS, SPSS, ODBC connections. Creation of new variables, transformation of variables, recoding, creating factor variables, recoding factor variables, dealing with missing values, sorting, merging, splitting, all the sort of things that you would expect to be able to do with data, you can actually do on the data that is actually much larger than your available RAM. Also, descriptive statistics and statistical tests, the things that you would expect to see here, sort of summary type statistics, min, max, mean, that sort of thing, your quantiles, correlations, also a few statistical tests like the chi-squared, Kendall, rank, Fisher's exact. Through the ability to do row selections, we can do sampling also. We can do sub-sampling through row selections, or we can do random sampling also. The predictive models also, things like your linear regressions, various generalized linear models, most of the ones you would expect to see, very similar to the GLM function in open source R, with the addition of a few like Tweety, which would have required a special package in open source R, as well as things like classification regression trees, your gradient boosted trees, decision forests, which would be our implementation of a random forest, and a naive Bayes model. Variable selection is available for your regressions. K-means clustering is available if you're looking to do clustering. And then at the very bottom right-hand corner, you can see a few things that are written as the sort of R combination. RX data step, RX exec, and the Pima R API. The RX data step is a way to actually just step through the chunks of your data, apply transformations, or do work on it and actually accumulate those results. RX exec is a way to actually sort of spread some arbitrary R code across the parallel backend that you've decided to use. You can think of it somewhat as an apply type function. And then the Pima R API is an API that allows visibility into the way that Microsoft R Server actually does the work on the backend, the parallel distribution. So it allows you to actually write your own parallel algorithms from scratch if you want to. Now, what does this mean? Of course, it does mean that we can scale the data that don't work, but it also means that we can see some performance improvements, because we have to think about it. Even if we have a machine large enough to hold all of our data using open source R functionality, the open source R functions don't really run any faster for bigger data, right? There is no real parallelism, unless, of course, we can leverage some of the MKL, which means that as my data size grows, our time is going to actually increase quite quickly. You can see on the left-hand side here is a comparison of a GLM model. And this GLM model is using the open source R function in blue, GLM, and then the function in the RevelScale R package of RxGLM. RxGLM is operating on data that actually it can be much larger than RAM. And as you can see here, as we increase in a number of observations across the x-axis, both show an increase in the amount of time, but the open source R function, GLM, increases quite quickly, up to almost 80 seconds there at just under 500,000 observations, and then actually breaks. On the particular machine we were testing it on, it could not continue on the next data size. RevelScale R, of course, you know, increases in time as we add data. However, it is a much more shallow increase in time. And this particular piece, though it stops here, is only because the testing wasn't continued. This will not break because it never actually brings all the data into RAM. It's only bringing small chunks at a time. The table on the right shows a little bit more comparison as we look at increasing the number of rows and how open source R reaches a point that it just doesn't work. And Revolution R, excuse me, this would be Microsoft R Server. This is a picture, so a bit of an older picture. But Microsoft R Server, as we increase in time, our increase in size, the number of rows, it continues on, and time increases, of course, but it doesn't break. One other example, and this is an example from a use case where someone was actually pulling data from a database, and so that they were actually pulling data into R via ODBC. And this is actually showing the sort of speed ups we can see by actually, instead of pulling data out of a database, pushing our computation to where the data exists. And so this actually has to do with how the distributed R piece. So if we push our data into the database here, we go from it taking 5 hours to actually pull the data, because, you know, it can be quite slow to pull a large amount of data over an OVC connection, to taking, you know, just 40 seconds there. Because the thing is we really want to minimize data movement as much as possible. So as we look at large, working on data that's larger than RAM, we don't want to only be just efficient at doing the processing. We want to make sure that we push that processing to where it most makes sense. So I just mentioned distributed R, and we'll talk a bit about something we call write once, deploy anywhere. And the nice thing is that when you're leveraging the code written in Microsoft R Server, the functions that are specific to RevelScale R, and we'll see those again when we look at code, when you've written that code to operate, say, locally, you can actually then push it to various parallel backends like, you know, Hortonworks or Cloudera, MapR, Teradata SQL Server. All of those are places that I can then push the work that I'm doing without any real change to my code other than, you know, pointing to where my data sits, since my data won't sit in the exact same place. All right, and so now we're going to move over to a demo session and look at a little bit about how this stuff actually works in code. And hopefully, for those of you who said what is R, I'll try to make this as clear as possible. For those of you who are intermediate, I think you'll be a little more comfortable with it. All right. So hopefully everyone can now see what I have open here. And to go with what I said earlier, if you're used to using something like RStudio, you can continue to use it. So we're using Microsoft R Server here, but it is running inside of RStudio. Since RStudio works with open source R, it works perfectly fine with Microsoft R Server. So what I'm going to do is show how we may do some work that would be pretty standard for the work that we would do with open source R. I have a CSV file that I want to import, and it's fairly large. I won't say it's not huge, but I want to show how this can be done, and it won't break things as I try to import it. But the thing is that as I try to continue doing work with it, it will break it, because the machine I'm operating on is just not quite large enough to be doing what I need to be doing. Now, so as this is importing, what I've done here is just pointed to this CSV file, and then I've just read it directly using the standard open source R function read.csv. The only extra bit I've thrown in there is I've specified my column classes. Now, this should take about a minute to do. As I said, it's not a tiny data set. I think we're at about 400,000 or so observations. And again, once it's into RAM, you know, we're where we want to be with open source R. And with any process, open source R, or actually Microsoft R servers, we're going to see some of the other functions in a second. The majority of the time that I would expect to see actually is going to happen right here as I import. Reading from disk does take some time. And we'll see the motivation for using something like the XDF file. Now, once this imports, what we're going to do is actually create a new column. What we want to define that as is just something that's late for 15 minutes. There are three. Let's go ahead and just look at this before I do anything. We can see that we have a little over 400,000 observations. Oh, excuse me, not 400,000. A little over 41 million observations. I don't know what I'm talking about there. And we were able to import this, and I have it in RAM now. These three variables, we want to add one more, and so we're just going to create this late variable. As we would expect, R is relatively fast once we have things into RAM, so we're able to create a new variable relatively quickly. You can see that we've added that late 15 there, which is a logical variable. And now what I want to do is actually try to create a logistic regression. And what I want to say is I want late to be I want to create a model where we have late regressed on a factor of departure time. So we're going to treat hour of day there, departure time, as a factor, and then day of week. So now I'm going to run this, and I want to say this is it's going to run for a little bit, and then actually we're going to reach that sort of dreaded I can't allocate a vector of a certain size. I will warn that it's going to take a few minutes, and so I'm going to talk a bit about that. This is quite common. As we're using open source R, we are often able, if we're talking about sort of moderately sized data, to actually read our data into RAM. It's then that subsequent processing I'm not able to do. It may be that it just takes too long, as we saw in some of the slides earlier with the GLM, or it may be that you actually run into the errors of it actually breaking. Again, this will break here, and I will apologize for the time, but I wanted to show an example that is large enough that you can actually sort of do something with it, but too large that it actually works. So that, unfortunately, does take a bit of time. So while we're waiting on that, I'm going to start talking a bit about what we would want to do next. Since this piece that we're operating on right now, the logistic regression, is just going to be too large to work, we need to consider using some of the functionality in RevoScale-R. RevoScale-R functions, you'll see in a minute, are generally prefixed with RX. So we know that we're specifically dealing with functions that can deal without a memory processing. Pardon me. We're going to start off with the same CSV file that we read in using read.csv, but instead of actually reading it into memory, what we want to do is actually import it into an XDF file, or that external data frame that we discussed. All right, I'm going to go ahead and stop this because this will break and we will receive the out of memory error. I'm going to go ahead and stop it. Hopefully we'll stop it. All right. Once that restarts, hopefully everyone can see that. Apologies for the time, but I did want to show something that would import fine, but then break when we try to do something else with it. All right, so I've defined one thing here, and that's our CSV, our airline CSV. So I have a pointer to my CSV file. And then I want to set up a path to a new file that I'm going to create that's going to be an XDF file. So this here, I'm just going to create a name, a location for that. There's a function called rximport that allows me to directly import data into an XDF. If I simply tell it that I want to import a CSV, it has some intelligence baked around it that it says, well, you have .csv there, so it knows that it's a CSV. And so you can do something as simple as just specifying I want to import this and then write out to that file. I don't have to specify anything more. However, when data are large, I think it's really good practice to specify as much as possible. That way you don't run the risk of you know, some intelligent, quote-unquote, bit of code missing out on something that you know not to be true or that you know to be true. Since that's the case, we're going to specify a few things, and that is, well, we know what the days of the week are, so I'm going to go ahead and specify those for factor levels. I'm going to go ahead and specify my column info, actually much like I specified in read.csv. I'm going to specify that my day of week is a factor, and then I'm going to tell it that the levels that it's going to use are these that I wrote right here. Then I'm also going to define something that's called a text data source. Microsoft R Server actually operates on data sources. If we pass it a path that's a string, these data sources are sort of inferred on the fly, but we can define them ourselves, and that's actually a little bit more efficient. So let me go ahead and start the import as I'm talking about it, because this will take a second. So we specify a text data source where I tell it that the file I'm going to read in is the airline CSV. The column classes that I want to use are the same as before. These are just a named list, whereas before we didn't have a named list. And that I want to have integer, numeric, and factor. This will match up exactly with the import that we did previously. And then I pass it a column info section to just tell it, well, since day of week is a factor, let's set the levels to days of week. All right, so this is processing here. As you can see, passing by in the console, it's telling us that a chunk of 500,000 rows was read at a time, and it tells us the timing that chunk took. This is sort of the standard output. You can affect that by setting things like a report progress as an argument, so you can tell it to tell you less about these sort of things or tell you more about these sort of things if you're interested in that. So we are almost done. This takes about a minute and a half. Our import with read.csv should have taken about a minute. This takes about a minute and a half, and the reason is that we're not reading into RAM. We're actually reading from disk and then writing back out to another file. So there is some that's brought into RAM because, as you can see, we're actually doing our transform as we're doing the import. And so what we're doing is creating our late 15 variable as I import the data and then write back out to the XDF file. All right, we're almost done. We're right above 40 million observations. All right, so now that we've created this XDF file, let's go ahead and look at it. There's a few functions that are available for exploring, but a really important one is rxgetInfo, and this actually just looks at some metadata that we have stored with our file here. So if rxgetInfo takes some arguments, like I can get my variable information, I can see the first n number of rows. When I run this, we can see that I have a file here. It's data airline.xdf that I just created. It tells me how many observations there are in there. So almost 42 million. It tells me I have four variables and that it's broken into 84 blocks. In this case, each one of these blocks was 500,000 rows. And actually, this is an argument that you can set also as you're doing importing. You can tell it how many rows you want to have in a block. I'll also say that next week there's going to be another webinar that I'm going to do about data mining. We're going to get into a lot more depth about how you do some actual hands-on work with this, these functions. The variable information actually tells us variable types, integer, numeric, and then factor. For numeric type variables, it tells us highs and lows. Those are pre-computed as it's brought in. And then it tells us the factors for the factor levels if we have a factor. Right? Now we can also do things that we would normally do, things like running summaries. So if we want to run a summary, instead of just running the summary function, we can use rxSummary. As you'll see, most all of our functions tend to take this formula notation. And so we have tilde late 15. So I want to see a summary of the variable late 15. You can see a lot of things flew by because that actually processed quite quickly. So that was actually reading from disk 3 seconds. So you can see that it was a much faster than reading from the CSV file, and you can see why we recommend the use of the XDF. I could have certainly run this summary directly on the CSV file. However, it would have taken the exact same amount of time it took to read, well, slightly less since I wouldn't be running back to disk, but it would take the time to read from a CSV like normal. So roughly about a minute versus only, you know, 0.3 seconds or so to read from this XDF file. I'm going to go ahead and throw one piece in here so we see a little bit less and then I'm going to run the same summary except I'm going to use day of week and then get late 15 by day of week. So when we run that, we'll see that again that ran by quite quickly. And I get the same sort of thing, is that I see now, though I have the mean would be what percentage of time were they late for a given day of week. I also wanted to show that, you know, you can create other variables on the fly here. I don't have to store them in the XDF file. So I passed a transform earlier when I was importing to create late 15. But here in my summary, I can actually pass a transform again and create a new variable called late 30. It won't be stored anywhere because I'm actually not writing back to the XDF file. However, it will create this and then give me the summary I was looking for. Now, as you see, this took a little bit longer. So at 0.3 seconds when I was doing summaries on a variable that was already in the XDF, a little bit more time when I have to create it on the fly because there's a little bit of overhead associated with that. In this case, I went ahead and stored that, and we can look at it. It looks exactly the same as the summary that we saw for late 15, except for, of course, you know, the percentage is a little bit less, which would make sense. The reason I stored it is to show you that this object that's created has a few pieces in it. It has a data frame that actually has just the single variable, so just what percent overall is late. And then it has a list in there for the categorical, which has the output that we saw that gives us the mean, standard deviation, min, max, that sort of thing, by the categorical variable we passed. All right. Next, we can do some things like plotting. And actually, I want to show a histogram, because histograms, if you think about it, often what we need to know is highs and lows, so we can determine where to actually set our breakpoints. Since the XDF file stores our high and low values there, we don't have to do multiple passes through the data. We only have to make one pass through the data. So let me actually, again, set report progress to 1 so we don't get quite so much output. And then I'll run this histogram, and we'll get a histogram of late 15 by day of week. And that pops up there for us. All right. Now, the last piece I wanted to show here is previously, we tried to fit a logistic regression, and remember, it took quite a while. I went ahead and stopped it, but it would have broken. We would have gotten an out-of-memory error that it couldn't allocate a vector of whatever size. Instead of using the GLM function, I'm going to use RxLogit, which is a specific function for a logistic regression. We actually have one, RxGLM, that is a more general function also, but RxLogit is specifically for a logistic regression. And so I'm going to run this, and we're going to see that despite the fact that before it broke, now we're actually seeing lots of things flying by because it's actually reading through all of our data. Since this is written using iteratively reweighted least squares, what happens is that we're going to pass through the data for one iteration, we're going to do some calculations, then we're going to move to the next iteration. So you'll see these things stream past quite a few times. You'll see iteration 2 popped up there. We're probably going to take around 7 or 8 iterations, I think, is sort of the general time that it's taken for this particular data set. But the thing is that as you see, what's happening is I'm only ever bringing 500,000 rows into RAM at a time. And I remember, I can set that. So if I have a smaller machine, I could set my chunk size to smaller, which means that I can actually do processing on something here. You're seeing on 40 million observations. I could actually have done processing on 40 billion observations on this machine if I had the storage space for it. As it's running by, I'll give this caveat. Right now, I'm running on the Surface, so this is a pretty small machine. But you know, the positive is that no matter what size data that we would think that we need to operate on, I actually can operate on it since I'm only taking small bytes each time I need to do processing. All right, so that's iteration 9 pops up, and we should have one more after that, I think. Oh, there we go. Iteration 10 is the final one for us. And so we did see, you know, hey, that did take 97 seconds. That's not, you know, maybe you wanted something super fast. But I will say this, is that as I move to a beefier machine, you certainly see these things run much faster. I think 97 seconds on me running on something that I can barely fit into RAM on a Surface is pretty respectable. When we look at a summary of this particular model, we see something actually quite similar to what we're used to seeing with open source R. And hopefully, maybe you can see here why something like this took so long. There are a lot of coefficients here, 168 total to be exact. Which means that, you know, I was doing a lot of processing over a lot of data, actually. I mean, 40 million observations is fairly large. All right, now, I will give one other caveat, and that you see condition number is a 1 here. This data was built this for the purpose of demonstration, and it actually is just a replication of a smaller data set. I wanted something big enough, again, that I could import, but too big for it to actually work on my machine. So there is a bit of sort of inflation of one data set there. All right, now, I've talked about how you can go about dealing with scalability issues locally. Now the question becomes, well, what if I don't want to deal with scalability issues, but I don't want to just run locally? That's where things like this compute context come into play. So I haven't set this previously because it's set sort of already when you start up Microsoft R Server. I'm using a local compute context, but I can define other compute contexts. So you can see here is a Hadoop MapReduce context. Now, I've not specified some of the arguments here because I'm not going to run this particular piece. However, I think you will see some examples of something like this if you look at the webinar that Jamie Olson is going to be giving about SQL Server. The same thing is true with the Hadoop MapReduce context. Compute context is that we can define compute context for SQL Server also. The thing is that the arguments that I have to define inside of this are things like what's the IP address of the head node, you know, where's a shared folder. It's something that you define once for a particular distributed compute context, you know, be that a Hadoop cluster or a, you know, say SQL Server. Those things don't really change. They're the same for pretty much everyone that's going to use them. Once you have those defined, and again, that's something you can save, you know, and distribute to your users as needed. You can also set up things like HDF file system. So the data that we had previously, I imported using RX text data. Now, if that text data sat on HDFS, the only thing I would have to add is something here that actually says the file system is this HDFS FS that I defined here. Now, of course, again, this path may be different, of course, because I'm on Hadoop. I may not have that locally. So if it is on HDFS, that path may be different. But otherwise, the code is pretty much exactly the same. I would also have to, if I'm going to do an importing, define where I would write my XDF file. And in this case, we didn't see this earlier, is that I can define XDF data source. And this is just saying that my XDF data is going to be located here. It's much like the path I defined earlier. It's just now saying that I'm going to actually put this on the Hadoop file system that I defined. And the import that I did previously looks exactly the same. The only difference is that since I'm let's change that. This piece should say Hadoop. Since we have a new text data source here. When I import that data from this data source, which is on HDFS, and then I write out to this XDF data source, which is on HDFS, what that means is that my data is going to be on HDFS. It's going to be in Hadoop for processing. Now, actually, I'm going to do one other thing here, and that is I'm going to move this set compute context up here. Setting a compute context tells the interpreter here where the work that I want to do is done. If I don't set it, of course, it's just done locally. But when I do set it to one of these compute contexts I define, that means that the work after this is actually run there. So in this case, if I set that compute context to the Hadoop compute context I defined, this import is actually run on Hadoop, on data in Hadoop, and then writes back to Hadoop, so it's all in HDFS. And then this logistic regression that we ran earlier is exactly the same, except for I had to, you know, change the name of my data here. However, that will actually be run in Hadoop. And so the thing is that we can scale up because we provide functionality to scale locally, but the distributed compute context means that we can scale up by pushing the work to where our data may sit, and allows us to actually leverage some of that those algorithms that are written to be block-wise computation, but on a back-end, a parallel back-end that actually makes more sense for us. All right, that ends the demo portion that I have, and I'll hand back to Yanni as we have a few more poll questions, and then I can address some of the questions that came up during the talk.
Great, thank you, Derek. I'll go ahead and push this question live to the audience. Would appreciate your help in rating the webinar overall. So let's see, let's go to some questions. How do I build locally and deploy remotely?
So hopefully that was at least somewhat clear, and that is that any functions prefaced with RX allow us to make use of things, make use of compute context. And so without changing a compute context, that's always assumed that I'm doing it locally. I can actually create models on data locally if I wanted to, and then actually just move things like the model object to that remote computation, and then use a function RxPredict by setting a compute context to the remote area, and that'll actually allow me to do predictions there. But as I demonstrated in the last chunk of code, I can't actually develop code locally and then actually say, you know, change pointers to data and then change my compute context and then actually make the creation of the models that I was going to be using done in those remote contexts.
Great, thank you. Is R server deployable on Windows?
So yes, but it is not I guess it's not a, how best to say that, it's not a volume license product. The Windows version of our server is available, but it is for use with SQL Server. So if you have an MSDN subscription, there are developer versions that are available on Windows.
This question comes from Eric. Is this R code going to be made available?
I'm perfectly happy to make it available, as well as the code I used to create the data that I used. I'm happy to share that also.
Great, thank you. We'll include that in the follow-up email. What's the effort of migrating existing R code into Microsoft R so it can scale?
So that's a great question, and it is somewhat dependent on what kind of R code it is. You know, if you have a lot of data manipulation things, I think those are actually oftentimes easy. You know, if I'm doing row-wise manipulation, creation of new variables, that's relatively easy to move to things at scale. If I'm making use of things like linear regressions and, you know, GLMs, random forests, or gradient boosted trees, those sort of things, that's going to be easy because those algorithms are already written and are part of Microsoft R Server, which means that there is an equivalent function to do the same sort of thing that you're already doing. The difficulty comes when you're doing things like I want to run a support vector machine and I want that to run on, you know, billions of rows of data. Well, that's unfortunately not an algorithm that we have written yet that is scalable. So there, the difficulty is higher because since the algorithm doesn't exist, it actually would require the creation of such an algorithm. So if we borrow those sort of, you know, I'm doing something that just doesn't exist, and this is a difficult question, it depends. Generally, if you do work inside of your code that has sort of lots of transposing, think of that as that's somewhat difficult because it's just difficult to move that to a chunk-by-chunk type processing. And I know that's not a great answer, but the best answer is it depends. It can be actually quite simple. For some code, it is as simple as a search and replace.
Thank you, Derek. A few questions about RStudio. Were you using RStudio Editor, and is it compatible with Microsoft R Server?
Yes, absolutely. So I was using RStudio, which works fine. There's been some releases recently on YouTube, some videos of the R tools for Visual Studio. I didn't use that yet because that's still not released fully. But there's you can use the Visual Studio add-in of R tools or Visual Studio. Anything that works with open source R that you're used to using, like RStudio, will work perfectly fine. So if I didn't say it, yes, I was using RStudio. I mean, if you like using Emacs and you use that with R, that works fine with Microsoft R Server also.
Great, thank you. How do I get data bigger than RAM into R?
So great question. And I think hopefully we saw with the RX import is probably the way we would generally do that. When we have data that's much larger than RAM, we want to make use of the functions that are available in the RevoScaleR package, those RX prefix functions, things that actually don't require me to bring all my data in RAM. So in the beginning of the code I showed, we used GLM, and that would require me to have all my data in RAM. We don't want to do that, right? We want to use things like RX import, use an XDF file, or actually stream directly from one of these data sources, RX text data that I showed earlier, something like that.
Thank you. What do you actually need to install Hadoop and run it there?
Hadoop, you need the Hadoop system up and running. And once you have that up and running, it is a relatively straightforward installer that installs on each one of the nodes. Microsoft R Server for Hadoop actually does need to be installed on each one of the nodes because R is the processing engine that's going to be used there. So it will have to be installed on each node. But once that's done, again, relatively straightforward installation process. Depending on which distro you use, there's also a packet installation. once you have that installed, it's a matter of actually just defining a compute context that points to the node at which you're going to initiate. So you're going to use an IP address for the head node, things like that. It is a relatively straightforward installation, and I say relatively straightforward because with Hadoop compared to other systems, nothing's that straightforward. But it is as straightforward as any other Hadoop related installation.
Thank you. Let's see. How difficult is it for the average R user to code using the Pima R APIs?
That's a great question. So it depends on the average R user's experience with parallel algorithms, the experience with distributed computation, that sort of thing. It's not that the R code itself is particularly hard with the Pima R API. It's the understanding of how to take a problem like, let me just use the example I used earlier, support vector machine, and how to break that down into something that actually can be done in a distributed out-of-memory fashion. I will say I think that skill is actually much harder than the R code. I mean, R code in general is if you're experienced with R, the R piece I think you'll be no worries with. The difficulty I think is much more around understanding how to create a distributed out of memory algorithm. So I will say this is if you had an example. That you had a paper or something that someone had developed that showed how to do out-of-memory processing, and you're a relatively good R programmer, the Pima API, I think you should be able to do that relatively straightforward if you have a predefined way to break the algorithm up. It's just the understanding how to do that's the tough part.
Thank you. How does this integrate with Microsoft Azure ML?
All right, so I mentioned at least a bit about Microsoft R Open. Microsoft R Open has the Azure ML package, Microsoft R Server also has that since we're built on Microsoft R Open. And what that does is allows you to create models locally that will then be able to push out to Azure ML, so you'll actually be able to create an API for Azure ML. Now, right now, what's running inside of Azure ML is not Microsoft R Server. However, in the future, that will not be the case. I don't know off the top of my head, the timing on that, but upcoming quite soon, I think you'll see that, Microsoft R Server will be the R engine inside of inside of Azure ML. But right now, that's not the case, not quite yet.
Thank you. I think we just have time for one more question. How do I plot my data when it is so big?
So that's a great question. And I think, we saw one way was using something like a histogram. This leads into actually a broader set of questions, and that is, how do I deal, with lots of things that I would have normally done in memory when my data is actually quite large? And I think plotting is a good example. If I have billions of rows and I need to do something, and I think I want to do a scatter plot, that's a bit problematic. The scatter plot itself is problematic, not just doing the plotting, but how you actually, visualize that plotting is problematic. And so sometimes when we move to data that is actually quite large, we have to change the way we think about how we do things. Using things like hex bin plots makes sense, right, if you want to do the equivalent or at least somewhat equivalent of a scatter plot. Microsoft R Server includes a number of functions for doing the sort of plots that make sense. However, things like just doing a direct scatter plot, maybe that doesn't make as much sense. So I think the important thing is to think that when my data actually gets really large, I need to think about what I'm doing with it a little bit differently.
Great. Thank you, Derek, for a wonderful presentation. Thank you, everyone, for all your questions. It looks like we're out of time. I just wanted to reiterate that today's webinar was recorded. The recording, along with the presentation link, will be emailed to you within 48 hours. Thank you very much for attending. Have a great day.
Thanks, all.